afternoon, everyone. I'm going to open us today as a meeting of the subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization today, December 14th, 2016, for the purpose of taking testimony. We expect that a few more members are going to be coming in, but we understand that many of you have concerns about travel, and we want to respect your schedules. So we're going to start with some important testimony that you've done us the honor of coming to provide, and then we will, when we have the members present to introduce some committee bills, we'll transition to that, and then we'll transition back to testimony. So we've opened the meeting as a subcommittee, and I would like to now open an information hearing and invite Director Marks, Jeff Rhodes, Will Higlin, and Andre Urso forward to provide us with an update on implementation of legislation we've passed and of Measure 91. Welcome.
It's cozy.
Wow. You can begin in whatever order makes most sense.
Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Rhodes. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kate Brown on marijuana. And thank you for inviting us to speak to you today about the implementation, particularly of some new testing requirements that we have here in Oregon. Since our last legislative days, much has happened in Oregon's cannabis market. Most notably, we have begun required product testing through licensed and accredited labs. The new testing requirements have proved challenging for both regulators and the industry alike. We found much tainted product in the marketplace, but we've also found that certain testing requirements are unduly burdensome for certain sectors of the industry in particular. Finding a solution has been a team effort that's involved both our industry partners and state regulators alike, and I'm happy to report that while far from perfect, I believe Oregon is headed in the proper direction for testing of cannabis products. Since the new rules took effect on October 1st, I've been listening intently to both regulators and industry experts concerning which adjustments to testing are needed. We hosted a large open meeting at OLCC, and we allowed the industry and labs to come in and weigh in on some of the problems and experiences they were having in the marketplace to give us their expert advice. Public comment was solicited. Those comments were taken to heart and compiled, and we then convened smaller solutions-oriented breakout groups to take a look at what we were going to do moving forward for further changes that might be needed or further adjustments that may be needed. The result of these discussions was put into place on December 2nd, which is a new testing regime, particularly for processors, that recognizes the cost of testing was too high and creating a barrier to entry. Now, at the same time, we have found tainted product in our system, and you may have seen health alerts coming out from the Oregon Health Authority. This is a very real concern as well, and something we're very cognizant of. Public health and safety is a real concern, and the December 2nd changes were meant to strike a balance between the appropriate cost of testing and the protection of the public. I should say, though, these changes are an interim solution. Pesticide testing is expensive, and it's complicated. Now that our interim solution is in place, we are looking to what the longer term is going to look like for testing in cannabis in Oregon. And we're going to be looking at a more market basket, randomized style approach to pesticide testing, more akin to what you see in other agricultural marketplaces. This system will have many moving parts, and it will need to be well thought out. So we're going to be working closely with industry experts to craft this new regime, and frankly, discussions have already begun with some of these people. But we'll be looking not only to the cannabis industry, but also to other agricultural industries where pesticide testing has been conducted for many years to see what they've learned and to try to glean some new ideas from them as well. But this all has to be weighed against a diverse industry that serves diverse end users, all the way from the recreational end user to an immunocompromised medical patient that may need the clean medicine more than ever. And also a diverse range of products from flower to concentrates, distillate, edibles, tinctures, everything in between. You can imagine the sampling issues that take place when trying to figure out how to test these diverse and ever-changing products. It's a daunting challenge, but one that we're excited to take on in testing. In the end, such a scheme will allow us to continue to test for pesticides with a high degree of scientific confidence while keeping the cost to the industry appropriate and not creating any barriers to entry. I do want to point out some of the excellent work that's being done by all of our agencies, but particularly the Department of Agriculture, because they're not here today. One particular program of import is the brand new Marijuana Compliance Assistance Program, or MCAP. This gives individuals the opportunity to enter into a compliance program in lieu of an enforcement action when pesticides are detected and the Department of Agriculture gets wind of that. It's a temporary program. It's meant to give the industry an on-ramp while adjusting to new pesticide regulations, but it's all done in the spirit of working together. ODA is hoping to assist rather than simply slamming down the hammer of enforcement, to work with people to figure out what works, to help see what problems are occurring with mites and what is going to be on the list of approved pesticides that will work for that. We already have 44 participants in the program, and it's an excellent example of working together. We've learned that in this startup market, listening to the industry and being nimble is the key to success. We're forging a brand new path with cannabis testing in Oregon, and our agencies have been responsive in crafting emergency rules where appropriate and listening and reacting to the concerns of Oregonians. In a marketplace where new products are constantly being invented, tested, testing and sampling becomes particularly challenging. And open discourse and thoughtful communication will be the only way for us to succeed in this environment. Just as an aside, I've had the pleasure of working with both excellent state regulators and extremely thoughtful and solutions-oriented industry experts in setting Oregon's policy on testing, and I want to express my sincere gratitude to all of them. As we look into a future where federal regulations are uncertain, this teamwork and cooperation will be of the utmost importance, and I'm sincerely looking forward to working with all of them. I'll turn it over to Mr. Marks here. But I'll be happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Chairman, committee, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director, OLCC. Pleased to be here today, and I'm particularly pleased to be the bearer of some good news with respect to the recreational system. Chairman Patridge does send his regards. It's been a busy year for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the Oregon's Marijuana Committee working together to establish this new recreational system, our work, and I hope this committee's work as well also continues, because there's much yet to be done. There's more work to do. But I want you to just take a moment to take some pride in the work that you have done. We've taken strides together with the industry to establish this legal consumer market envisioned by ballot measure 91, envisioned by this committee through your legislative works. In fact, we are now, in the process of licensing from farm to retail. And each day we have harvest, transportation, testing, processing, and sales taking place within the recreational system. Our very immature market has established its strong core. We have a complete functioning market, not to the scale yet that we'll see at the conclusion of Early Start. And that's been a part of the issue with Early Start and the significant testing requirements. Entry for retailers to our side of the system has been slow. That's been a disincentive. But even in spite of that, our weekly sales now are $1.2 million per week. That's good news. We're building up. And in spite of all those concerns and obstacles, many folks have found their way through them and into the recreational market. Our success to date at accomplishing this work clearly doesn't fall just to us, but to those new entries to the recreational market, those folks that ventured forth and got licenses in the face of a lot of uncertainty financially, in terms of testing, in terms of the regulatory environment they're in, and they really plunged into an uncertain world of licensure, testing, and tracking, and are making it work, and they have my sincere thanks, because without them taking those steps forward, we wouldn't be here to report good news. It'd be rather dire. Even more good news, between Early Start and between our sales since October, we fully are going to be able to pay back the borrowing against the liquor fund. We're happy about that, and that's really a credit to the Early Start program. We sort of financed our way into it by that, and it's worked very well and that was clearly a effort of this committee. As planned, early start will end at the conclusion of the year, and the recreational market is poised to rise up in service to recreational customers in 2017. Our work will be to grow. This market is strong and profitable and exceedingly legal industry that we recognize serves important economic development goals throughout throughout Oregon and for our regional economic development as well. We're very aware of the acute problems the industry is experiencing right now on both the industry and regulatory side of the equation. We're having to make choices, set priorities, and navigate some territory that's unfamiliar to us. But this agency, and I think the state clearly, aspires to create a regulatory system that is respected across the nation and a model for the work going on in a growing number of states in the country. Before Will Higlin shares some details on sales and our licensing progress, I just kind of want to thumbnail sort of our to-do list now. First on that list is we're going to have to buck up and license like there's no tomorrow here at the end of the year. We're going to have to get energy drinks for our staff there. They're working very hard, so I want to recognize how much work they've done, how much energy they put in. But we're going to have to re-energize to meet the end of the year needs and the beginning of next year's window to actually pull in more processors and license retailers into our system. Not all of the businesses nailed the timing that they wanted to get licensure by us, so you know there's going to be a lot of anxiety that that licensing happens quickly right now. So we've created sort of a bunched up window of necessity to get through that, and we can move through that very swiftly when licensees have done their homework, have their lux. We can move fastly, and we'll strive to keep pace. Second, we're committed to be strong participants in the process that Jeff Rhodes just described. I'm very grateful that Jeff is here taking this on with us. He's provided exceptional leadership to the agencies. We want to be a part of the solution in working to achieve the proper testing balance. Weather permitting, tomorrow the Commission will act on permanent rules that will streamline many processes for industry, and with if they accept the staff recommendation, will also benefit hemp growers that want entry to our retail stores. I'll just sketch a few of the highlights of things that help industry. We had required 90-day backup on off-site video. We're going to 30 days. We don't think it compromises the integrity of our system, and this is a real cost savings for the industry. We are, you know, I think you're familiar with the U.S. Department of Justice and DEA advisory on sort of hemp and their equivalent of the Cole memo for hemp. We initially were going to allow hemp products in our stores. We flipped in our rules. Our commissioner saw a lot of anxious hemp industry participants that wanted access to our retail stores. We're flipping our rules back and going to provide that access. And it has to meet our requirements, which is basically what they're prepared to do already. They got to meet our labeling and packaging standards to come in. We can't have them in our processing stream or with our licensees because you've only given us the authority to regulate hemp or marijuana, and that's hemp, and we don't have authority to deal with that. So we will be releasing, if you haven't seen it or prepared to release, the Oregon Department of Justice advice concerning that, and I think they outline in there some details and ways that you might want to regulatorily address hemp to make it work better, whether it's on our side or ODA's side. We're expanding the opportunities for kitchens, shared kitchens to work, and we actually found out that it's not just edible manufacturers that need that. There's some processing that is taking place in these kitchens. Particularly for like infused butters and things that are used in cooking. We're just received sort of the knowledge of this, and we're made changes. So hopefully the commission will adopt those changes tomorrow that allow some processing to take place in these shared kitchens. We are codifying the prohibition of strain names that the commission adopted a temporary rule on. So Girl Scout cookies and those items that appeal to children or are marketed by children will not be allowed. We showed, I think, tremendous restraint. I'll ballpark the numbers, but, you know, we picked 10 to 12 out of 365 or 300. And surprisingly, it's been pretty well received by the industry. I think they wanted that professionalism. I've received zero grief on this one, just so you know. And then we're codifying the changes that we made in testing standards for flour that OHA provided to us earlier, so that cut testing by about two-thirds on the flour product. We'd implemented that shortly after the beginning of October. There's some changes that will take place under the work that Jeff and others have done, but we're making that happen. In 2017, last on maybe the to-do list there is we've got to move into a posture of enforcement. We know this industry needs enforcement. They're asking for standards to be met. They're also asking for enforcement against the illegal markets. We're providing some coordination efforts today because we are become the repository of all complaints regarding marijuana, hemp, OHA grows, illegal grows. It's hard to discern out there in the public which are which, and we do need some coordination and guidance on that, not only on figuring out who responds to the problem, but actually seeing a response to the problem out there. I'm hearing it from all quarters. Last on our to-do list is work with this committee. We hope and for your continued movement forward together. The expertise that you bring has really been invaluable to our agency and will be and has served the industry and the customers well, and so we look forward to working with you in 2017. And with that, I'll turn it over to Will so you get some of the numbers.
Excuse me a little. Madam Co-Chair, excuse me, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Will Higlin, Senior Director of Licensing and Compliance at the OLCC. And I believe you have some handouts in front of you that I'm just, you know, I'll be brief in my comments today, but I just wanted to go over some high-level numbers, both on the licensing side and then what we've actually pulled out of our CTS system. So the licensing update, I'll go by license type. We have 18 laboratories, 21 processors, 353 producers, 108 retailers, and 26 wholesalers. Staff notified me about an hour ago that we probably have 30 to 35 applications that will be approved today. So it shows you, I think, the push that's starting to happen as we get closer to January 1st. I can tell you that we're poised. We've got all our resources ready to go, but we're really waiting on applicants to go ahead and make that final push, get their applications completed so we can actually go and license them before January 1st. We've done a lot of notifications over the last 6-8 weeks to let licensees, especially on the medical side, if you're going to flip, please get us your information as soon as we can so we can take care of everybody that we possibly can before December 31st. So that kind of gives you a licensing snapshot right now. As far as some of the information that's coming out of the CTS system, first of all, sales activity. If you look at the charts that you've been provided, as far as retailers by week that we currently have in the system, they're averaging around $17,000 a week in sales. You can notice on the charts, if you look at the edibles and concentrates, just for the diagram shows, is that they have peeled off in sales since October, since we flipped. That has to do with some of the testing requirements that Jeff and Steve talked about. We're very committed to the processors, though, as they get closer to the beginning of the year to get the processors in this system. As the testing requirements are changed, make it easier. We anticipate that we'll get flooded with those applications, and we intend to focus on those and get them flipped as quickly as we possibly can. Steve mentioned our total sales. We're averaging about $1.2 million a week in sales. And I thought this was interesting. Sales by type. So if you look at the OMMP program and the REC program, under our current retail situation, about 12% of the overall sales is coming from the OMPP program. I've had a lot of questions about that. As far as the CTS system itself, you can see where most of the product that's being sold in our system today, about 70% is the flower. Packaging and labeling update, I'm happy to report we're caught up. You can see on the chart there that we've approved 681 packages, and we've approved 350 labels with three in review, and we're waiting on 229 packages to be approved. But we're all caught up as far as internally with this process, and frankly, it's gone very smoothly. Total sales, we're at 9.4 million since October 1st. 8.3 of that is recreational. 1.1 is the medical sales. The cannabis tracking system, so we're tracking product now. We have 455 licensees in the system. We've had 13,300 harvest events to a total weight of almost 2 million wet weight harvested. And then on the testing side, which there's been a lot of conversation, we've passed 1,500 tests. We have 1,270 waiting, and 95 tests have failed. So that kind of gives you a snapshot of all the different buckets in the cannabis tracking system and overall what's going on with our licensing efforts. So with that, I will answer any questions or turn it over to Andre.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for record, Andre Uso, manager of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. So Mr. Rhodes touched on some of the testing changes that have occurred recently, so I just will elaborate a little bit more with OHA's testing regulations that went into effect October 1st. Since then, we've gotten, we've heard a lot of concern from the industry about the burdensome nature of these testing rules. So recently, the Oregon Health Authority has issued two sets of emergency testing rules to alleviate some of the regulatory burden while still maintaining public health and safety for products that, that reach the market or that patients would use. So as I alluded to recently, the OHA has adopted temporary testing rules aimed at lowering the testing burden for producers and processors. We did this based on concerns and input from the marijuana industry, cannabis industry. While these new testing rules do lessen the testing burden to some degree, they are still protective of public health and safety, and the Oregon Health Authority has been concerned and has continued to see contaminated product being tested. Information that we have shows that we have seen about 400 failed pesticide samples. This represents about 15% of the total amount of pesticides, I mean samples tested for pesticides. This is primarily in the medical sphere. I don't have the numbers for the recreational sphere. I would guess that it would probably be lower than 15%. So the rules that we released on December 2nd, and then rules that we filed yesterday and will be effective tomorrow are not intended to overhaul the entire testing regime. However, the intent was to provide some temporary relief from the regulatory burden and facilitate the availability of cannabis items to the retail market and to patients, while OHA will be working with the governor's office and its sister agencies in early 2017 to look at overhauling how testing is done, particularly with pesticide testing in mind. To touch on some of the specifics of these testing changes that have occurred this month, we have loosened some regulations on labeling requirements for processors so that they can pre-label products before having them tested for potency and allowing them about a 5% leeway. For example, a 50 milligram item could be pre-labeled 50 milligrams, and if it contained 47.5 milligrams or 52.5 milligrams, it could still be continued to be labeled such as 50 milligrams. In addition, for quality assurance testing and for homogeneity of products that reach the market, the Oregon Health Authority has reduced sampling and testing requirements by approximately two-thirds. So products should start flowing to the market a little bit faster because of the lessened amount of testing that's required. In addition, for craft growers and producers that have small batches, we have allowed them to combine certain batches of multiple strains of cannabis to be tested at once instead of separately, which should also alleviate some of the testing burden. Don't want to get into too much of the specifics of those testing, the technical aspects of those testing rules, but OHA is confident that this should relieve some of the burden going into the new year, and as we work towards developing a more comprehensive testing regime in 2017. Additionally, I did want to note that ORLAP has done a remarkable and admirable job in getting laboratories accredited since the summer. Currently, there are 19 laboratories accredited in the state of Oregon. Now, only four of those are accredited for the for testing for pesticides, and two are accredited for subcontracting the testing of pesticides. However, the Oregon Health Authority and ORLAP cannot force laboratories to decide which scope of testing that they want to choose. Those are business decisions that those laboratories make based on market factors and what's good for their business. Currently, we have about six or seven other laboratories awaiting final accreditation, and ORLAP will get to them. They have done site assessments for those remaining laboratories, and those laboratories just need to come up with some corrective plans to complete the accreditation process as we move into 2017. Overall, the Oregon Health Authority is looking forward to the end of early start and transitioning back to a purely medical program. But we also look forward to working with our partner at OLCC and facilitating the transfer over of those businesses on the medical side that have been participating in early start and getting them over to the OLCC side in 2017. I'm available for any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, all of you. Rep Buckley, then Rep Helm, and then do we have?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, just wondering, appreciate all the information. Are we at a point now where we can make any kind of rough estimate of the number of labs that we need to have in the state overall to have the industry have an effective lab process?
I think that's a question that would be best answered by those laboratories about their individual capacity to handle that testing of the product that's coming in. OHA believes that 19 accredited laboratories is sufficient for potency testing. However, you know, there is a minimal amount of laboratories that are testing for pesticides, and based upon geographic location and client intake, that may be contributing to some of this backlog that we've been hearing about. However, those are business decisions that those laboratories need to make. And if they would like to make that decision to get accredited for pesticide testing, then ORLAP would definitely be available to provide those assessments into the future.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just overall, given the fact the labs are so crucial to this bottleneck, are lab applications prioritized in the process on both sides?
Chair Steve Marks, yes, we've been pushing labs through as quick as we can, and we were poised very early on. We had to convince labs to step forward, right? There wasn't a market, there was flour, so those early ones that got in, those folks that got in the process are known to us. We've been tracking them very closely with Andre and ORLAP as they make their way through the process. So as soon as they're done there, we virtually pop them through. We're making sure they put in place applications with us so they're ready to go, and we actually have 24 applications in.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Rep Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this be for anybody who, any of you who, anybody that thinks they know. I don't want to pick on anybody, so that's the point. And so, Will, your information, the bottom of the first page gives us sort of sales by week, recreational versus OMMP patient. And then we had some other information here that leads me to wonder whether are we seeing a trend that we might start to think of as lasting into the future about the number of medical patients leveling off and whether we're going to see a stabilization in medical cards. We've had a discussion over the past couple of years about whether we would see folks continue to try to utilize their cards over time or whether they would relinquish them in favor of an easier system that's now coming online. Are we seeing that?
Madam Chair, if I may. Representative Help. We have about 68,000 OMMP patients right now. That is down a few thousand from last year. That may be due to several factors. One of those factors is that HB 3400 got rid of out-of-state patients. So we've lost about 3,000 out-of-state patients this past year. So we don't renew their cards as they come up for renewal. But we've seen a pretty consistent level of patients. You know, approximately 70,000 is pretty similar to what we've seen in years past, a little bit down. As far as the types of products that they're purchasing or where they're purchasing from, indications show that they do get about 12% of sales out of the retail facilities from OLCC. I don't have those exact numbers as far as the medical dispensaries. We still have 350 medical dispensaries in the state of Oregon. That is down from 425 in October. So some of those dispensaries are making that flip over to the retail side, and we truly won't know how many we have left until after the 31st of this year.
Thanks. So it's too early to tell, so I'm hearing.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Rep. Wilson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, I guess this question might be for you. On social media especially, I see a lot of smack going on about where our tax revenue is going as a result of the sale of marijuana products. We obviously have a distribution formula in place for that, but a lot of people don't believe it's going where it's purportedly going, where statutorily it's supposed to go. How do we make that case? And again, I see a lot of foolish talk about, well, that tax revenue is lining people's pockets and making people rich within government and things like that. I know that's ridiculous. But the question is how do we really make a case to the public that the distribution formula is alive and well and the money is going there?
Boy, you gave that question to me, Representative Wilson. let me start off. First, the money first is going to this repayment of the liquor fund. So we know that revenue is going to one thing that's very clear. And when we repay the liquor fund, and you can speed up that process. We can't quite reconcile exactly how much the borrowing was until the end of the biennium, but you can certainly make it possible to repay like 90%, and then we can balance out the last 10% of the payment after the biennium closes or something like that. You can speed that up. But it's going there. Counties and cities will see that. We'll distribute it in a monthly check. It'll be a lump coming into the county and city coffers and to the state part of the distribution. That money will go where it's supposed to. On the other hand, I don't think people have seen it go anywhere because there hasn't been any money distributed. The money's coming in. Discussions were, through October, about $55 million in revenue, I believe, is the state's official estimate. That money will get distributed through the formula, which is a little complex for both revenue and us today because of the local options that took place out there. Local options, there's different periods of timing when people were in and out, there was no way for us to clearly know how each local option was written. So what did a yes mean? What did a no mean? We've got to work with AOC and LOC to get that information and maybe a certification process in place so we can actually make the distribution. And I think the legislature is going to have to provide some guidance to us on the timing of which formula goes in place when potentially on that. Maybe something that we just figure out with working with your fiscal folks and DAS to figure out how to do that, but we probably have a bifurcated formula right now that we have to distribute. So first time through, people shouldn't have seen the money. It'll start flowing, you know, next biennium it'll be easier and easier to see. That's
I do.
Fair enough.
So then it's safe to say at this point that the money that's being collected is going to repay the liquor fund and holding that for that. Okay. If I may ask another question. Andre, for you, with the number of medical dispensaries going down like they are from 425 to 350 in fairly short order, question I would have for you is what does OHA know right now about excess marijuana coming into dispensaries right now? We know that all excess marijuana grown in the medical side is supposed to be going that direction into dispensaries. My question is, what do you know about that? And are dispensaries reporting taking in quantifiable amounts?
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Representative Wilson. from all indications, that there seems to be a pretty good flow of medical cannabis into the medical dispensaries. The stuff continues to be tested for pesticides, continues to be tested for potency, and we continue to see a very good flow of usable cannabis into medical dispensaries.
Okay, thank you. One more?
Yes, please.
Okay, Steve, back to you. I want to talk to you again briefly about the micro canopy portion of the law. How is that going? And could you give us an update on record here as to what that looks like and how that is going in that, as you and I have talked before, I've got a lot of medical growers in my part of the world, and for those who are wanting to, in an economical fashion, convert, how's that playing?
So, you know, we had a lot of the license applications through our normal process before you provided us the micro tier, and then we got it later. Actually, we haven't seen that many people take the opportunity to get in the micro tier specifically. A lot of small growers were in our regular tiers, and maybe it's because they wanted flexibility to consider their future. I'm not sure why that is. I know we've talked a little bit about, do we need to do something more to alleviate the cost and the regulatory burden for these very small micro grows? And like, as we discussed, I think our process that we can provide waivers now, we understand how to do that. We spent a lot of time, of course, across last summer, right, working with the outdoor grows to figure out how to do that. I think we have enough flexibility to make that work to about the level where you'd have some semblance of tracking, some semblance of security. Perhaps not, you know, necessarily the same with the Dahlia that we do through the CTS system, but I think we have the ability to do that. We haven't clearly seen the demand, and I think there's a real question about, and it will be debated about, you know, can they make it? They're not of commercial scale. I know when I wanted to be a guide on the Rogue River, I couldn't become a professional guide because and do a couple trips a year. I was going to have to do 20 trips a year to afford liability insurance. We're going to have to figure out how to lay those folks into the system. I think that's the real hat trick for the next session with our focus on that. I know how much this committee cares about making sure medical growers are treated fairly and right, and that patients can continue to get their medicine. I think there's some things you can do within our system that facilitate that patient opportunity to receive cannabis products in higher quantities, but a lot of ideas around that, and I think it's one where we're just going to have to, this committee is going to have to work together and with the industry to figure out how to lay that in properly. But it seems possible to do with all the revenue that's here, with the commitment that it's here. I think there's a lot of options for us to deal with that, for you to deal with it.
Thank you. Okay. All right. One more. Yes, Rep Buckley, please.
I just wanted to ask on behalf of Rep Olson. Actually, Andrea, I was going to ask, there were concerns about, as we set up the system, that perhaps we'd put ourselves in a situation where medical marijuana patients were not having access to medication as we move things into regulation. Have your department received concerns or complaints at a increased level from patients not being able to access medicine, or is there any feedback on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, we have received some concerns from patients about having access to particular product types. The usable cannabis doesn't seem to be so much of an issue. I think patients have plenty of access points for usable cannabis. They can grow their own, they can have a grower that's designated for them, or they can access a dispensary. I believe with the testing regulations coming on board, there were some hiccups and a little bit of a roadblock for some certain product types getting to patients. So we believe with the loosening of the testing regulations and then overhauling them in the new year, that patients should continue to see a good supply of product types going into the future.
Great. Representative Olson says thanks.
Okay. Would you like to ask anything on behalf of Representative Buckley? All right.
Be inappropriate.
nothing for today. All right. So thank you. I'm going to thank this panel, and we'll, in the interest of time, well, thanks for being here.
One more thing. I just want to, Andre and I talked about it before we got here. We've talked about it internally, and Jeff is focused on it as well. When we make the flip and early start ends, those dispensaries will have to end their recreational sales. And I know OHA is committed to work on that, but that'll help us. We're committed to work to flip those folks as quickly as possible in their system. But that's got to be a clarity we have here. So don't be surprised when you see some, to the extent and abilities that we can do it, enforcement taking place, right, from Andre's side of the coin and ours efforts to make them flip. But that's a part of the industry obligation here. It's part of the respect for the law that you created. And we want to make sure that happens properly and that those folks understand that this program has come to a close. There is some, I think, confusion about that out there. Mm-hmm. Not to end on a dire note.
You know, we actually, Rep. Helm would like
just
to ask.
Just one more question, like Colombo. No, that your response, Steve, and thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me, made me wonder, do you have an anticipated method of that early enforcement? For example, is there going to be inspection plus a warning period? Or I think people would feel better if they knew what was coming.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we've taken a very progressive response to how we're doing sanctioning and how we're working in terms of education with our licensees. So, for instance, when we go out and look at packaging in the first instance, it's really going to be a safe harbor. It's going to be to see whether you get the right things. Are you doing the right labeling? Is it working well? Those regulations are really confusing, right? There's a lot of changes along the way. There's no doubt there are errors in the system there, and we'll help them correct them. We've had on transition problems with recorded inventories transferred in or transferred out at the wrong time. Pure legitimate errors and not understanding a system. There was education around that. There wasn't fines and sanctions about that. We're going to continue that posture. I think the things that you're going to see us hold bright lines are sales to children, sales to people who shouldn't have sales, things you should know about the quantity that you can sell to any customer, the things that are sort of requisite for being in the business, right? Those are the things you'll see us respond to and enforce in the forces. But the fact of the matter is, and I'm a bit concerned, is we're going to have so many people on licensing in half. I mean, it's even pulling from our alcohol side that, you know, we're not going to be able to put everyone on enforcement anyway. So some of this, we're going to be out. We're going to work to do some decoy sales missions to get out there to show what we do and how we do it. You'll see some sanctions, but we won't have a tremendous amount of resource to go out and do that enforcement initially. Not probably until we get through April, beginning of renewals, and things start hopefully normalizing at some level for us, and then we'll see how that works for the next budget process. But our approach has been educational. We don't want to play gotcha, but there are certain things that are very clear, and we do expect compliance on those. And we have a progressive range of sanctions. So, and this has worked on the alcohol side forever, right? You get fined monetarily. You get fined a number of days. Usually you have an either-or option until it gets more serious, and then we make them close, right? So we make them pay higher. So we have that in place here, and you can survive being sanctioned. In the liquor industry, it happens all the time.
Excellent.
Thank you.
We have an additional question for you.
Yeah. So. Just one. Jeff, for you, I don't want you to get out of here without being able to answer a question here. This may sound like a beach ball, but really I'm interested in this, and that is, you mentioned in your opening statement about the fact that the cannabis industry can learn from other crops, and I think so too, and I just wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about that? What would we learn from other crops, in your opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I think it's important to take a more holistic approach to testing as we move forward, and I've gone out to many farms, I've seen how these products are grown, and what is abundantly clear is this is agriculture, and so I think it would behoove us to look to other sectors of that industry to see what they've learned, how they conduct testing, and learn from their successes and failures as well. So But the issue is we need to do that with an eye towards the uniqueness of the cannabis market, which is one that serves both recreational and medical end users, that has such a diverse set of products. So we'll be looking not just to those agricultural industries, but certainly to our industry experts here in the cannabis industry as well, to see what they think we should be doing as we move forward, because we're going to have to find some sort of a middle ground between all of those concepts. So it'll be a very interesting process as we look forward into doing that.
Great, thank you.
But what I should say just further, Representative Wilson, is this type of process allows us to test with a high degree of scientific certainty, but test in a more randomized fashion. This is one way that we'll be looking, one thing we'll be examining for a testing regime, whereby you can continue to test to that high degree of scientific certainty. And the fact that it's more expensive to do so is less important because of the amount of testing that's happening in a more randomized fashion. So that's one of the things that we'll be looking at.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for your testimony, and we hope that you get safely to wherever you're going later today. I want to preview for the group what's happening next. We have an industry panel update on testing, labeling, and packaging, and then we have a legal update essentially speaking to how the change in the federal administration and the regulatory context what kinds of things we may expect from that. And then we have a plan to introduce committee bills. We have until 2 p.m. for this meeting. So, and we also have at least one member who needs to try to get on the road at 1:30. So if the Senate comes in and we can do committee bill admission, then we'll sort of leap from where we are to that. It looks like they're coming off the floor right now. Our goal is to give everyone time to present, but because the Senate has been handling some appointment issues and, you know, we're obviously not here yet, things have gotten a little bit thrown off. So wanted to give you a preview of where things are going, so you won't be surprised when we do the things that happen in the next hour. I think I'd love to invite up Anthony Taylor, Roshan Reardon, Jeff Sugarman right now to provide your testimony. I think the senators may come in, so we'd like to get started with your panel, and then if they come in order to get Rep. Buckley on the road, we may take a pause from this panel and then come back. I think we shouldn't dial, you know, we could dial in William Simpson, but I think since he's at home, maybe you can contact him and let him know that we're running late, and we'll try to reach him if we can. And please begin in any order. We're a little bit pressed for time, but we are really thankful to you for all your work, and we want to hear what you have to say.
My name is Roshan Reardon. I am the managing partner of Greenleaf Lab. We're an ORLAB accredited and OLCC licensed cannabis analytical lab. So I want to thank the Joint Committee for inviting me to testify today. I really appreciate that. I also want to thank the Joint Committee and the state regulators for ensuring the progression of a properly regulated cannabis industry by adhering to the October 1 testing deadline. While we understand that minor changes are always needed when creating a new system of rules for a new industry, the state has taken a positive stance in ensuring legitimacy for Oregon's cannabis industry and the market and safety for its consumers. Oregon should be proud that it is helping to set national and world standards in regulated cannabis. Requiring analytical laboratories to be accredited and licensed has been a long overdue portion in Oregon's cannabis industry. It has now allowed businesses to start working from a level playing field. Accreditation, licensing, and standardization are normal requirements for all regulated industries. Cannabis in Oregon is now becoming a part of a regulated industry. With regulation comes growing pains. When Oregon first experienced regulating gray market dispensaries, there was a transition that occurred at that time. Some dispensaries were able to comply with the rules, and others were not. The same transition is occurring again for all segments within Oregon's cannabis industry today. Oregon should continue to support businesses that abide by the rules, and those that embrace a regulated market that helps protect consumer health and safety. Part of participating in a regulated market means testing products that are sold within it. This includes ensuring businesses that perform the testing have proven their capabilities and their competence. This also includes ensuring that standards must be met in order to sell one's product. Those standards must include public health and safety, as well as accurate information for consumers. It's part of our society. This is what we do in regulated markets. We understand that some are experiencing growing pains from the transition from an unregulated market to a regulated market. We also want to acknowledge that we have spoken to many, many businesses throughout the cannabis industry in Oregon who have planned ahead, and they're now succeeding in this regulated market. Those businesses are having their product properly valued. Those businesses are now able to operate in a level playing field. When the new rules were published, I was concerned about being able to comply with them and succeed in my own business. However, I put my mind to it, I planned ahead, I hired the proper employees and personnel who are qualified, and I put all of my resources into ensuring that I could meet the new standards set by our government. Many other businesses in the cannabis industry have done the same. We have chosen to succeed with these regulations instead of fighting to have them pushed back or changed. Understanding that minor tweaks may be required, a wholesale change to the rules will only set back Oregon's cannabis industry. What the cannabis industry now needs now is stability. We need stability in rules for packaging, labeling, and testing, so businesses can determine true problem areas versus the growing pains associated with changing business plans. Common sense regulation is here, and rolling back the rules that Oregon has chosen to ensure a legitimate and safe market for the cannabis industry is only going to hurt Oregon in the long term. Let's be proud to know that Oregon is a leader in creating a safe and legitimate cannabis industry, as well as a level playing field for all businesses. Please let me know if you have further questions.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I would suggest that I'd like to have us go through all the speakers on this panel if we have the opportunity before the Senate comes in and hold questions till after that. Who would like to go next?
Hey, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Chair Line and your members of the committee. My name is Jeff Sugarman. I am the Chief Compliance Officer for Groundworks Operations, which is essentially a fancy title for saying that I'm in charge of getting all of our licenses for the 7 applications that we have in front of OLCC right now that run the gamut of the industry, from retail stores to producers to processors. So far, we've gotten 3 of those licenses, and we hope to get the rest of them before the end of the year, shortly thereafter. But I've essentially spent the last 18 months getting these licenses and working with the OHA and the OLCC and the ODA and the Department of Revenue, trying to work our way through this system. And it seems like every day we learn something new, whether it's that we need a mop sink in a retail store that sells only prepackaged food yet isn't allowed to provide free coffee or espresso or tea to our customers, or changes to testing rules that essentially go into effect the minute that we read them, or the announcement that ORLAP really can't certify enough labs to get us through this particular period of time, or a point of sale system that still doesn't quite talk right to metric. So I think we've every day in this industry, people are struggling to follow the rules and to do the right thing and to keep products on the shelves for their customers. And while we're inching our way forward, and we all know that we're going to get there in the end, it's been a very difficult and trying 18 months, and I think a lot of that is being reflected in what we're hearing from people today around testing and ORLAP and labs and the system in general. Meanwhile, the inspectors that we're working with have huge caseloads. They are under very tight timelines, as we are, and lots of paperwork. And those agency leaders are equally swamped with the policies and politics of this new industry. And even more, meanwhile, on the national landscape, our national landscape has just dramatically changed with the nomination of an attorney general candidate who says good people don't smoke marijuana. It feels as if we have been, in a sense, consumed by the crisis of the day, and we have lost sight of the broader scope and the challenges of this new industry. So I think we need a bit of a reset. We need to come together both as policymakers and industry participants to make this system work, not just for our customers or our constituents, but to protect us from whatever changes may be coming from this new administration. I'm glad that we're in legislative session again, because I know that when we worked closely together last session, whether it was in hearings or in work groups or in meetings, we identified and we solved problems that went across every agency and across all of the industry. Remember, midway through the 2015 session, this committee was on the verge of collapse, and it looked like the entire program was going to be at risk. But through this committee, and a lot of other hardworking people, we came together and we found answers, and we need to do that again this session. I sincerely hope that this committee and the governor's office use the next 6 months, beginning right now, to keep convening us to solve these problems. We do need a fix to the testing rules and the costs right now. The entire supply chain that really has never failed us in literally decades seems like it's driving on I-5 at rush hour right now. We've put safe and exceptionally quality product out in the market for many, many years, and we've run into a roadblock, and we can't seem to get products into the system. I think it is true that we need to get more labs certified and more labs certified soon, and I know that's going to be a difficult process, and I don't have an answer to it, but I think the changes in the pesticide rules and the addition of some more labs, we can solve those testing problems. But the longer it takes to solve those problems, the harder it's going to be for this industry to keep product in the system and keep this regulated market alive, and I think that is really the ultimate goal of what we're looking at here. We're on the verge of being able to open a very safe, very successful new industry that is already paying huge dividends to the state and the local jurisdictions where we operate. This legislature is going to be able to rely on cannabis tax dollars far greater than we ever imagined and are ready to grow much higher. We won't take care of the whole $1.7 billion, but we can take a bite out of it. So I know every one of us in this room is committed towards working towards successful implementation. We need your legislative leadership. We need the governor's continued and growing involvement. We need to fix the testing rules and the lab certification, but always keep in mind the broader goals of our regulated legal of our system. And I am very, very confident that we can do that. And I just want to say, too, in closing, that I have worked with many inspectors and staff people and agency managers, both at the local and the state level, and they have been working exceptionally hard. They have been incredibly professional. They have been reliable. They have been responsive. It has been a great pleasure to work with these inspectors and staff people throughout this process. And I know we're going to get there in the end, but we've still got a lot of work to do this session. Thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Taylor. I'm the president and co-founder of Compassionate Oregon, an nonprofit advocacy group for medical marijuana patients. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on patient issues to this committee today. I must concur with the folks here at this table that the industry, and therefore the patient, is in a tight spot. In fact, patients are in crisis mode right now with not much relief in sight. Supplies are short and expensive, and when products do arrive, they don't last for long. Unlike consumers who can wait a day or two, if their dispensary doesn't have what they need, patients that need cannabis every day don't have that luxury. But while patients
are facing the issues of supply and demand head on and are hanging on. There remain, there remain other issues facing patients today that are of greater concern to them. And in my short time before this committee, I'd like to address two things. First, a few of the numbers, then the issues. As this first slide shows, since January of 2015, the number of patients that do not register a grower has doubled from 8,600 patients, to over 16,000 patients. Speculation by some attribute this increase to the number of patients finding it easier to quit the program and purchase product from a dispensary or other places, but we hold this increase is too large over too short a period and can be easily refuted with one simple question. Why would any patient suddenly decide to start purchasing their medicine from a dispensary when they've been getting it free from growers? It's a position of Compassionate Oregon. This decline is a bit more complex, and we believe the increase in the number of patients that do not designate a grower is a function of the three following factors: plant limits, grower site registration fees, and reporting. These three factors resulted in a dramatic reduction in grower availability and put many patients in crisis mode because they cannot find a grower and cannot afford to purchase the medicines they need from their local dispensaries. This eventually forces them into the illicit market, removing testing and other public safety protections. These three factors threaten the very fabric of this program, which is the right for patients to grow their own medicine and to grow for others that cannot provide for themselves. The following slides are simply, from the Department of Revenue showing the decrease in sales once the new testing rules kicked in. This one shows the number of grandfathered sites that came about after the grandfathering rules of 3400. And then the last two are just more for your information about CDC relating to pain management contracts and cost savings by Medicare in states with medical marijuana programs. And those are for your use. I'm not going to get into them at this moment. It's in my testimony. So now the issues.
May I interrupt for one moment, please? If it were possible for you to conclude that in the next 5 minutes, then we would have time when this whole body is here to do committee bills before we go on to Mr. Simpson. Does that work for your presentation?
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks.
So I want to speak to other issues patients face that I believe this committee is in a unique position to help resolve. Issues that affect the everyday health care of medical marijuana patient cardholders and non-cardholders alike across Oregon. These issues rise above whether or not a patient can get the product they need at a dispensary because they already have a grower. They already have access to the quantity and quality of medication they need without interruption. They have a doctor that does not treat them differently because they use cannabis as an adjunct to pain medication or to help them sleep or to ease their Parkinson's, and doctors who will sign the patient authorization forms. I want to talk about doctors being allowed to have this conversation about a patient's use of cannabis without their administrators telling them they can't, about issues that affect the very quality of life, end-of-life care, and access to cannabis in residential care facilities. I want to talk about drug testing in the workplace for substances both a recognized medicine and legal for any Oregonian to use. And I want to talk about the difference between being under the influence and taking medication, the medication called cannabis. I want to talk about issues that need resolve for the medical establishment, like dosing and frequency of dosing and dispelling the overall stigmatization of the people that find the use of cannabis as medicine beneficial. And I want to talk about the data that the simple charting by our healthcare professionals can provide about the use of cannabis by Oregonians. I want to talk about the CDC's recommendations to quit abandoning patients under discriminatory pain management contracts for testing positive for non-prescribed substances or an indication that the patient is not using the medication as prescribed. I want to talk about how we educate our physicians and healthcare professionals and administrators of Oregon's medical establishment so the 20% of Oregonians that suffer chronic pain and are being prescribed opioids have the option to use cannabis not just available but also explained to them. And I want to talk about the 25% reduction in opioid deaths in states that have medical marijuana programs and the savings to those states that begin to take advantage of these options. And I want to talk about why there's only been one bill introduced in this building in the last 2 years that addresses these very real and sometimes life-threatening concerns of patients. But above all else, I want to start the conversation about the experience of this committee, about how the experience of this committee gets us down that path, how your understanding and the knowledge that you've gained over the last couple of years can help other members in this building, specifically healthcare committees, to help resolve these issues. I want to have a conversation about why we can't have legislation working its way through the building that addresses some of these issues. At the same time, we're pushing industry interests. We can do these two things at the same time, and this issue requires it. Patients are indeed in crisis, and it isn't just about whether they can find the products they need, but the more real issue of no longer facing discrimination in their healthcare choices or treatment options by the medical establishment simply because they integrate cannabis into their treatment plans. Patient issues like these are an important part of the equation that makes Oregon one of the leading medical marijuana programs in this country, and how we need to continue to be progressive in our approach to medical marijuana patients. Now is not the time to place further restrictions on the OMMP, but it's time to expand it to other Oregonians that may benefit from such efforts. Thank you for this opportunity to provide a bit of insight into some of the other issues patients are facing.
Thank you so much. So, committee members, I will request that we hold questions, and this panel can actually, you can be seated. We're going to move now into committee bill introduction, and then we'll resume by calling Mr. Simpson. If you need to go in the intervening time, we understand it is starting to snow. So you can go ahead and leave the witness area, and I'm going to gavel us in for the whole committee. So I'm opening the December 14th meeting of the full Joint Interim Committee on Marijuana Legalization. And now, in the interest of having as many members as possible here, we're going to move forward into, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills. And I'd like to preface it by saying we've learned from the presiding officers of both chambers, or I've certainly learned from my presiding officer, Speaker Kotek, that the Joint Committee is going to continue into the next legislative session, but I want to give people a heads up that the scope of work of the Joint Committee, we understand, is going to be narrowed. So we're going to introduce committee bills today, but the fact that we introduce them as committee bills today means neither that everyone on this committee promises to vote yes if there is a vote on those bills in this committee, nor does it mean the bill will necessarily remain in this committee. My understanding is that the narrowed scope will probably be focused on things that are perceived to be directly implementing Measure 91, which is a little bit, leaves some definition to be defined. But anyway, that's where we are, and we appreciate the opportunity to continue working together. So thank you to the presiding officers. With that, Mr. Vice Chair, do we have a motion for introduction of committee bills, please?
I do, Madam Chair. I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 452, dated September 1, 2016, LC 908, dated September 26, 2016, LC 1086, dated December 13, 2016, LC 1087, dated September 16, 2016, LC 1468, dated December 5, 2016, LC 1476, dated October 18, 2016. LC 1477, dated October 18, 2016. LC 1478, dated October 18, 2016. LC 1479, dated October 18, 2016. LC 1726, dated October 18, 2016. LC 1882, dated December 5, 2016. LC 1901, dated December 5, 2016. LC 1922, dated October 18, 2016. LC 2290, dated October 18, 2016. LC 2377, dated November 9, 2016. LC 2942, dated November 30, 2016. LC-3163, dated December 4, 2016, and LC-1935, dated December 14, 2016.
Thank you very much. That's when having a radio background really comes in handy. Right? So Vice Chair Wilson has moved that the legislative concepts, as recited above, be introduced as committee bills. Now we have discussion, and in the interest of transparency, I've asked our committee administrator to read a sentence about each of the bills so that people who are listening have at least a very top-line sense of what Vice Chair Wilson was just describing.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, LC-452 directs the OLCC to enter into an agreement with a non-governmental entity for the purpose of conducting research into cannabis. LC-908 makes it illegal for an employer to prohibit use of a lawful substance under state law as a condition of employment. LC-1086 contains changes to the State Controlled Substances Act, removing almost all references to marijuana, and creates a control and regulation of Marijuana Act. It also adjusts criminal penalties related to marijuana. LC-1087 clarifies section of the minor in possession statutes relating to both alcohol and cannabis. LC-1468 creates the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission and moves most of the licensing authority for medical marijuana to OLCC, with the exception of medical marijuana producers. That is moved to the Department of Agriculture. LC-1476, 77, 78, and 79 were placeholders requested by the committee. And make, by and large, technical changes and clarifications. LC-1726 comes to us from the League of Oregon Cities and mirrors OLCC's alcohol civil enforcement language for marijuana. LC-1882 creates the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, moves most of the licensing authority for medical marijuana to OLCC, and asks OLCC to work with the Department of Agriculture for the purposes of regulating medical marijuana producers. LC-1901 moves most of the licensing authority for medical marijuana to OLCC. LC-1922 creates a cannabis lounge license type. It allows social consumption of marijuana lounges, and also creates a cannabis event licensure with a local opt-in. LC-1935 creates the Oregon Cannabis Commission and transfers almost all OHA regulatory authority relating to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act to the Oregon Cannabis Commission. LC-2290 creates a task force on social consumption. LC-2377 changes the tax disbursement payouts to 30% going to cities, 30% going to counties, 20% going to the OHA mental health and addictions budget, 15% going to the Oregon State Police, and 5% for drug abuse and prevention. LC-2942 allows local governments to create an 8% local tax, not above the 3% local tax. And LC-3163 directs the Department of Ag to solicit proposals to create a water and power efficiency standards relating to cannabis.
Do we have a 1935?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do have a LC-1935 that relates to the Oregon Cannabis Commission.
Okay, so with that, we have the motion to admit these as committee bills that would enable us to have full discussion of the merits of the bills later. Is there any discussion on the motion to admit as committee bills now? Yes, please, Senator Prudlansky.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know that you made this announcement. I think it's important to just maybe say it again. We've just heard of what the LCs are. We just got a one-liner on that. For all of us that are going to be voting in support of introducing, this is a means to allow those bills and those concepts to come before this committee or other committees in the legislature. Does not mean that each and every one of us are going to support each and every part of each of those LCs. Based on what I heard, I think I would probably have some suggestions, maybe making some modifications. So we'll wait until 2017 to do that. But thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thanks for the clarification. Any other discussion? All right. Is there any objection? If not, the concepts are introduced as committee bills. All right. Now we will close the work session, and we will reopen the informational hearing. And we have heard from three great panelists from the industry and medical users and labs, and we have one more one more person from industry who is going to testify by phone, Mr. William Simpson of Chalice Farms. And then after that, we're going to move to the third and final panel for today, which is a legal update from Mark Mayer and Rob Bovet regarding the change in landscape at a federal level and what that may mean for us here at the state. Hi, Mr. Simpson, Ann Leininger here from the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for joining us today. I understand that you've been tracking the committee hearing today by phone, so you know that we're at the part where we call you.
Yes, I do.
Wonderful. If you could, we'd love to hear your thoughts on how things are going with testing, labeling, and packaging as part of our industry update.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is William Simpson.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Testify here today.
Pardon me, second. Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Burdick has a comment.
Thank you, William. I just wanted to let you know that you have heard the testimony of the previous panel, and we have not, we in the Senate have been stuck on the floor way past the beginning time of this. So we came at the tail end of the previous panel. So don't, if the House would bear with me, don't worry about repeating any of the information that's relevant to what you want to say, because this will be the first time the Senate has heard most of it.
Understood.
Thank you.
So I'm the owner of Chalice Farms. We are a 100% vertically integrated cannabis company. We are holding OLCC licenses for production, processing, wholesale, retail. Before I start, I did want to thank this committee for your leadership, the long hours you've spent learning, listening, and crafting sound legislation regulating a new industry. This last year has been especially challenging for cannabis businesses, including my own. We have experienced rapidly changing regulations, various deadlines stacked up against each other, and general problems that arise from significant transition. The cannabis business community has always been nimble. However, the last 4 months have been beyond difficult, even for the most well-established, well-capitalized, and secure businesses. The problem has been the following. On October 1st, new testing regulations went into effect. Those testing regulations were over-onerous and failed to take into account the economic impact of such strenuous rules. The new testing rules resulted in tests so costly that some of our best small batch edible producers, large scale processors, and many in between had to shut down either temporarily to raise funds or permanently. Even though the agencies have been open to working with stakeholders, which we value and appreciate, the changes have not been quick enough, and even the new set of rules do not go far enough to fix the primary problem. I do want to thank the governor and Jeff Rhodes for quickly understanding these problems and attempting to fix them. His work has resulted in some correction of the problem, but has not resolved all of the serious problems. While we recognize that the changes necessary to remedy these problems must come from the regulatory agencies, we still need your help. We are asking that you support the cannabis industry by urging the rulemakers to act quickly and make some specific changes. We need to fix the rules regarding pesticides, specifically the requirement to destroy failed material. Instead, should be allowed to engage in remediation. The problem here lies mostly on concentrates and extracts. As flower can pass a test, and then after concentration, it will fail, but could easily be filtered or diluted. We need to ensure that ORLAB is properly staffed and funded. Certifying and licensing labs should be a top priority. Without enough labs, we're experiencing significant delays and increased costs. And as they just went over, we have 4 accredited pesticide laboratories, and we were not able to keep up with testing with 20, 30, 40 labs in the past. We need to readjust. We need a readjustment of batch size for batch size regulation to be more thoughtful and nuanced. The OHA just released some new batch sizes, which help edibles, concentrates, and extracts, but don't fix the issues around grower batch sizes. There should be a reassessment of the process validations case study procedure to ensure that cannabis is being held to the standard of an agricultural product and that we are not recreating the wheel for a perceived threat of harm. In addition to supporting the business community by joining with us to ask for the necessary changes above, I also want to draw your attention to the fact that the ODA, OLCC, and the Oregon Health Authority currently have different acceptable pesticide standards. This is seriously compounding the challenges discussed above around testing.
Wonderful. Thank you. Committee members, do any of you have questions for any of the industry panelists who have just spoken to us?
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
Billy, could you just go into a little bit more detail on how remediation is used in other agricultural products and how it differs for cannabis and what kind of impact that's had on some of the actual growers like yourself and others?
Yeah, so in crops, in working with the Department of Agriculture, if there is a certain analyte or pesticide proven to be in a crop, they allow remediation through continual growing and then retesting to show that you have been able to grow a long enough time for the half-life of that certain analyte to be under the action level. With other products, such as a marmalade from a fruit, they allow for dilution and or filtration of products to show that they're under an action level. As an example, right now, I can purchase, and I have purchased flour from a farm that had a past test, said it was completely clean. We put it through our CO2 extraction process to bring it down to a raw, then to take it into a distillation process to create an ingredient, a THC cannabinoid ingredient, for our edibles. Well, once you concentrate it down that far, all of a sudden our test is showing that that pesticide is now above an action level. And although the state has set an amount that said that they were okay with, so if it tested at 0.19, they were okay with that level, but now that it's a concentrate and it's over, we have to destroy it, which is an extremely costly endeavor. When we could take that product and filter it or dilute it into different products, and then through a market assurance test, prove that it is back under that safe level before it would ever go to a consumer. I mean, it's absolutely, our industry is absolutely committed to public health and consumer safety. We want this to be based around science. Right now, there is no scientific evidence in any peer-reviewed literature that says what is safe or isn't safe. They have certain levels, but it may be 50 times that level. It may be zero. No one knows.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for this panel of industry representatives? No. All right. Well, then I'll.
Can I respond to Representative Buckley's question on capacity issues that he had asked earlier? And I know the state representative or the state was unable to answer that question. So it'd be best deferred to a industry.
Madam Chair, yes, can I ask that question to the industry representative?
Could you please do that? Or if you'd like to have Representative Olson ask for you, that
would be. Let me ask that for you.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Yes, thank you.
Do you want to sit on this committee again?
Thank you.
If you could please state your name for the record again and then again.
My name is Rashawn Reardon. I'm the owner of Greenleaf Lab.
Please, let us know your thoughts on capacity.
Okay. So with the instability right now of all the rules, it's really difficult as a business person to commit to purchasing another $800,000 to $1 million worth of instrumentation. I spoke to another laboratory who had the same stance. So there are labs. We have space. We have the ability to expand our capacity. But because these rules are constantly changing from a business perspective, it's just something that businesses might not be able to do right now. So I thought that it'd be important for you all to realize why some businesses might not be getting more instrumentation at this time.
Thank you. That's helpful. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. So might not or will not? I mean,
well, the issue is, I mean, we've had, three sets? In October 1, they were talking about pushing back the testing rules. We just had another change on December 2. We have another change now. And so everyone's talking about changing them again in the legislative session. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, these instruments are really expensive and you have to hire people and the whole process costs money, which is okay. But if those rules change so significantly and drastically that the pesticide testing is not going to be at the level as expected, then we have these loans or these instruments that will be essentially unused.
If I might, let me just ask a dumb question then. What is your counsel?
Our counsel?
What's your advice to us?
Yeah, what's your advice?
On the pesticide issue?
Yeah, on this on issue
which,
of always
of the capacity issue.
This issue of changing, as we have done, as the agencies have done on a regular basis, changing standards. So, what would you tell us about that?
Well, one, I would say that. I do believe that cannabis is an agricultural crop, but it did start off as a medicinal product. People consume it for health reasons and health issues, and so those standards need to take that into consideration. Secondly, cannabis is consumed oftentimes through inhalation, which is in our lung system, and there's not a lot of research. The only actually industry that would have research on smoking pesticides is the tobacco industry, and so we don't have an understanding on how these pesticides are necessarily going to potentially harm somebody, and so I believe, one, we need the data out there. I mean, right now with all the laboratories and all the required testing, all these laboratories are now collecting information and data on all these pesticides, which before didn't occur. Our laboratory offered pesticide testing in summer of this past year. Nobody ordered the testing with us. We ended up offering the testing for free 1 month before the rules were going to be in place so that our clients would get the information they needed because they chose that they didn't want to plan for it. So I mean, I feel like pesticide is extremely important. I understand the cost issue. I also want to let everyone know that these costs are real for a regulated market. Other cannabis laboratories, other non-cannabis laboratories, charge between $300 to $500 for a test. Right now, testing is running, including pesticide potency and water activity and mold, is running around 7 to 8 cents a gram for flower products. And so I understand people are having to change their business models for these price structures, but they are doable and they are reasonable. When it comes to accreditation, the issue on accreditation and pesticide testing, I mean, I think that's a conversation that has to occur about ORLAP, but they do require these very stringent standards for laboratories to prove they have competence, and I think that's one of the issues why there are not a lot of labs who have been accredited yet, is because it takes competence, and you have to prove your technical expertise, which had never occurred in the past. And so that's one of the issues of the pesticide, and hopefully I answered your question.
Thank you so much. All right, I don't see any other hands, so I'll thank all of the panelists from this panel. Now, it's getting snowy outside, but we have in our presence right now Mark Mayer and Rob Bovet, who can speak to us on some legal issues and the changing landscape. So I'd love to have you gentlemen join us. And
it's been a pleasure serving with all of you.
And this is Representative Buckley is leaving the stadium last night as a state rep, I believe. So maybe we should give a little tiny round of applause. So all right. Good colleague. Thank you, gentlemen. Please let us know what we should anticipate.
Madam Co-Chairs, for the record, Rob Ovett, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. And I'll start it off here and defer a lot of the conversation to Mark, and I'll be very brief because I know time is waning. Just a real quick update on local options and what the election last month told us. You may recall the various options. I won't bore you with this slide. You've seen it about 10 times before. We also are still in the process of developing time, place, and manner regulations in a lot of counties, so this is an evolving issue. I won't spend any time on it, but it's a big learning issue for our members. So. Much like the agencies, moving forward, you're going to see adjustments and amendments to time, place, and manner regulations to be responsive to industry concerns and neighbor concerns as well. So we deal with time, place, and manner, including land use, fairly heavily right now. Local taxation and opting in and opting out were the big subject of the recent elections. There were 337 local ballot measures last month, in addition to the 7 statewide measures, and I have a list of all 344 or whatever that is, and a 10-page PDF that's on OLIS right now, and so you can see all of them listed out with all the results, at least the preliminary results haven't been certified yet. Of those 337, 184 were about marijuana, so Oregonians voted on a lot of ballot measures. In terms of opting in and opting out, there were 61 counties and cities that had opt-in or opt-out elections, 6 counties, 13 measures, Three voted to allow and four measures. 55 cities, 60 measures, 24 voted to allow, 25 measures. So it was kind of a mix and match. Some of the results actually kind of surprised me in the sense that areas of the state that had opt-in, opt-out, that you would have suspected the voters would have opted in, didn't, and vice versa. An example is Gillum County, which was not just a no county. They were a hell no county. And they voted to allow both medical and recreational businesses, as an example. So I'm not sure what those messages really tell folks, but, you know, we obviously are strongly in support of local elections and local choices. In terms of a marijuana retail tax, there were 111 ballot measures on retail tax, the 3% local tax, and all of them passed, 111. And they didn't just pass. They passed overwhelmingly. 75% was common. So it is apparent, at least to me, that Oregonians hate sales tax, but they love marijuana sales tax. So go figure. I don't know how to explain this, but the results are very, well, they're quite clear. These were the counties that I didn't put all the cities up, all the counties that voted in favor of a local option tax. We also, of course, had national or elections around the nation. Prior to this last election, there were 23 states plus D.C. that you're all more than familiar with. And then we had elections in a bunch more states. So we have what appear to be three new medical marijuana states added to the list. Montana also expanded the amount of plants you can grow. Those all passed. And we added, it looks like we added four more recreational states, although, as you can see, Maine is so close that it's driven a recount at 50.17% yes. It's clear the California, Massachusetts, and Nevada measures pass, and it's clear the Arizona measure did not pass. Of most significance, at least from my perspective, is the fact that California passed recreational marijuana. We've had real trouble, as you all know, getting attention from Congress to do some things we really, really want them to do. And we'll see if maybe this latest election can change at least a piece of that. And so you asked me to put on my, I guess, crystal ball and try to figure out what the national election means, not just based on what I showed you, but also the fact that we have a new administration coming in. And a lot's been written about him and his approach to marijuana, as well as what appears to be his choice for Attorney General. But so with a big caveat that everything I say from here on out is just my opinion, and I have as much clue as anybody else, or probably less clue than most of you. I'm going to just blather for a little bit, but defer much of this to Mark. So, of course, we've all been operating under two things. One is the what we call the Cole memos, the Cole and Wilkinson memos, that basically is prosecutorial discretion. Of course, we've been licensing people to commit federal crimes, but so what if the feds don't care or don't prosecute? And that's what the Cole memos basically tell us. But that could change tomorrow with a new president. They could revoke the Cole memo. They could add conditions. They could tweak it. They could change it. It's all prosecutorial discretion. There is another thing that just is worth mentioning, which is the continuing resolution that we're operating under at the federal level until April 28th. There was a provision in the last budget bill that basically prohibited the federal Department of Justice from using any resources to prosecute people for medical marijuana if they were in compliance with their own state law. So there's that issue as well. So a piece of it is prosecutorial discretion, a piece of it is congressional action. So what does it all mean? Not really sure, but keep in mind that we do have the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which, among many other things, tells Congress they cannot require you, the Oregon legislature, to enact or unenact anything criminally under state law. So they can't force you to recriminalize anything. It's the anti-commandeering doctrine of the 10th Amendment. That doesn't mean they can't try to coerce you to do it this way or that, especially with purse strings. So who knows what action Congress will take, if any. In terms of my own predictions, which I'll get to in just briefly in a minute, and before I turn it over to Mark, Of course, we have asked Congress to fix Section 280E of the Internal Revenue Code so cannabis businesses can act like normal businesses and take normal business deductions. We've asked them to fix the banking law so we can get the money, the cash money, out of the system because it's a big public safety issue. If they don't fix the Controlled Substances Act, if at least they could fix those two things, that would be of immense help. So what are people projecting the new Trump administration are going to do? I noticed this Time magazine article came up with seven reasons why they suspect that the new Trump administration isn't going to do anything different, isn't going to change anything, which, of course, if that's true, that would be good news for the industry. I tend to agree with the first six. I'm not so sure I buy Time magazine's seventh argument, but whether Time magazine's right or not, I just don't know. I really just don't know. It's an unpredictable situation. My guess is they're probably right, because I think I find those first six reasons pretty darn compelling. And I think it would be fairly easy for a Trump administration to just throw up their hands and say, yeah, we may not like this, but states' rights. Just let the states continue to experiment. And I guess if I were forced to prognosticate on my crystal ball, that's probably what I would speculate. That's where my money would be betting. And that's what I have for you. Turn it over to Mark to get into more details about federal preemption and such things.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
Chairs Burdick and Leininger, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I was asked to testify, and I will make my testimony brief, about the potential of the Cole Memorandum being retracted or rescinded by the upcoming administration and the effect that that might have on Oregon's marijuana law. I'm actually not going to go too much into preemption. I'll take questions on that if you would like. Preemption is a much more delicate and complicated analysis than the Cole Memorandum itself. And as Rob testified, Cole Memorandum is a prosecutorial discretion document issued during the Obama administration to federal prosecutors, directing them as to how they should prosecute marijuana-related crimes. What are they going to prioritize? States that have enacted recreational marijuana laws, they've used this, and probably wisely, as guidance for how to implement their systems. But the thing for this committee to remember is that the legal basis for Oregon to enact these laws and regulate and tax marijuana is divorced from the federal executive branch's actions and what it does with its prosecutorial forces. So the Cole Memorandum itself doesn't affect the legal basis for Oregon and how it goes forward. If the Cole Memorandum is rescinded, if Sessions directs more aggressive prosecution of marijuana-related businesses and that sort of thing, it could result in federal crimes being prosecuted with businesses that are legal under state law. But you guys have known that, and you've known that that was a possibility all along. Probably another thing for you to remember is that the Cole Memorandum, it is not the first memorandum, nor was it the first action by a state involved. And states have had actions far beyond or far before that time. Decriminalization started in the 1970s with small amounts of marijuana. In 1996, the first regulatory system was set up with California's first medical marijuana bill. And that has just somewhat snowballed. Obama's first memorandum that came out, the Ogden Memorandum, was a lot lighter on how it looked at these issues and in how it stressed prosecution should be had. And then they issued the Cole Memorandum, which was actually a little bit tighter than the Ogden Memorandum. So it's not that it's not important. It's important for policymaking. It's important for you guys to look at it and think about it. But it isn't going to disrupt the legal basis by which Oregon can go forward if it is completely rescinded. So that's the first thing. The legal basis, it does involve preemption analysis, whether state law preempts or federal law preempts state law. For that, it requires an analysis of both the 10th Amendment and the sovereignty that is granted to the states in the 10th Amendment, just like Rob said. It also requires an analysis of Section 903 of the U.S. Code, which is the preemption clause contained in the CSA. I won't go into it into too much detail, but very briefly, that clause establishes a direct conflict preemption of state laws. That's how it's been interpreted by the federal courts consistently. And if you look at the courts and how they have looked at that in different situations, including Oregon v. Gonzalez with the Death with Dignity Act, they have typically had a hands-off approach unless something was in what they call direct conflict. If you want more information on that, I'd be happy to testify to that, or I would be happy to answer questions about it. I'd also be happy to address it in an opinion. But for now, that's going to be my that's going to be the end of my testimony. Any questions?
Excellent. So we have a question from Senator Pozanski and then Co-Chair Burdick, please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Rob, I'm sorry I had to take that call when you were talking. I've been thinking not only on the cannabis issues, but just in the sense of general state rights and health and safety. I've had an opportunity to talk to someone at the Department of Justice, and I was going to be making a contact with the Legislative Council, because to me it seems like we need to be looking at not just in cannabis, I know that's why we're here today, but there's multiple areas, and I'm wondering if either you, Mark, this, you know, will be in your bailiwick and being LC, as to looking at what the parameters are for a state on health and safety to be able to have a difference of opinions where the federals are. And I understand the preemption and all that is, has to all play in there, but it just seems to me that based on what we're seeing in the newspaper, without knowing who actually is going to be getting appointed and what their philosophy and positions are going to be, and I think the cannabis is an excellent area to look at, that we do need to be looking at what we can do to preserve and ensure that citizens of this state are not going to be adversely impacted.
Senator Pozanski, chairs of the committee, Senator Pozanski, just to comment briefly on what you said, it is important to understand that Section 903 of the CSA, which sets up the preemption of state law, it provides the most leeway for states to act underneath the federal regime. Only direct conflict of state law between state law and federal law will be preempted. So that gives a lot of leeway. If you look, I've been reading a lot of cases on this lately. The one that is probably the most interesting to people in Oregon is Oregon v. Gonzalez, which involved death with dignity, and the court did come down on the side of physicians can do this. It is within their bailiwick to do this. It is within a state's sovereignty, and it's within their police powers to do it. So does that apply directly to this situation? It doesn't. Just for, you know, to comment on what you had said, that is kind of the field, the lay of the field here, the lay of the land for you to think about as you're moving forward.
Thank you, Co-Chair Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to get to the, because it seems to me that with the budget line that said that they wouldn't enforce against marijuana offenses, did you indicate that that's no longer in the continuing resolution, or what is it, its status? Is it
yeah, so it permanence? Comes from, if I remember correctly, Section 524 of the last omnibus budget bill that basically said, Department of Justice, thou shalt not use any of the money we are giving you to enforce federal marijuana laws against medical patients who are using marijuana in compliance with their own state's medical marijuana laws. The Ninth Circuit has endorsed that and dismissed a whole lot of cases as a result of that. So I don't really work a whole lot with Congress, but they just passed a continuing resolution to continue that budget at service levels until April 28th, I believe. To give the new administration and new Congress time to develop a budget. So the next omnibus budget bill, it will be interesting to see if there is an equivalent to Section 524, if it expands to retail, if it doesn't exist at all, because that's an additional layer of, I don't want to use the wrong term, but I'd say protection for Oregon cannabis businesses beyond the Cole memo. So that's congressional protection, and then we have the Cole memo as an additional protection against federal prosecution. So all of those things are up in the air. I agree with everything that Mark just said in response to Senator Brzezinski. And like I say, if I'm having my crystal ball, I'm kind of lining up with the recent Time magazine article, and maybe I'm just deluding myself. I just can't believe that a new administration is going to try to unwind all this.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Rep. Wilson, please.
So then the relationship between the Cole memo and the omnibus budget bill, understanding that the omnibus budget bill reaches into the new year, does the Cole memo not because of a change of administration?
Well, certainly I'm not a federal practitioner, but my take is that that's a Department of Justice directive. So the new administration would have to revoke or change it. Okay. It's going to survive the swearing in, but I don't know by how many hours, days, weeks, or months.
Right. Okay. So thank you. That was an interesting summary. I believe that we've made our way all the way through the agenda, and the snow is coming down. So happy New Year to everyone, and we look forward to seeing you in January. The meeting is adjourned.
Madam Co-Chair, before you do that, please. And those who want to stay, we do have judiciary starting at 2 to 5, so please don't run.
If you want to stay for months and months after this, that's right, because we may be snowed in. Thank you. Yeah. Right, because we may be snowed in. Thank you.